story for these problems.
Martin, kannst du dein Mikro ausmachen kurz? Das gibt sonst so ein Hintergrundgeräusch.
So, welcome everybody. This is the seventh lecture in our course, Perspectives on Bikuni Ocean, held by the Women in Buddhism Study Initiative and the Numata Center for Buddhist Studies at the University of Hamburg. And today's topic is Maichis in Thailand. And it is my pleasure to welcome Dr. Martin Seeger to speak to us today on this topic. Martin Seeger did his MA in 2001 and his PhD in 2004 in Thai Studies at the University of Hamburg. He is at present Associate Professor of Thai Studies at the School of Modern Languages and Cultures at the University of Leeds. He teaches modules on Thai language and culture, Thailand's modern history, and modern Thai Buddhism. In his PhD dissertation, written under the supervision of Professor Bastiaville and Professor Lambert Schmidhausen, he investigated public intellectual debates in current Thai Theravada Buddhism that are relevant to several fundamental questions regarding the meaning and function of the Pali Canon. This investigation focuses on debates in which the Thai scholar monk Pa Ayutto has been playing a significant role. From 1997 to 2000, Martin Seeger was ordained as a Buddhist monk in northern Thailand. Much of his current research focuses on the life and work of the Thai Buddhist thinkers Buddha Das and Hitmu, Tra Payutu and Kun Ying Yai and Damrong Asan, and Kun Mai Mon Tang Bon Tong. I'm not sure if I'm able to pronounce this Thai word correct, but Martin can correct me later. Martin has also done research on development monks in the northeastern region of Thailand, human rights in Thai Theravada Buddhism, and Thai Buddhism and environmentalism. He continues to work on female saints in Thai Buddhism. This is much for introduction. Now I leave it to Martin Seeger.
At ethnographers and also by Thai Buddhists themselves. So here I will, and I have to say I not only necessarily agree, of course, with how women have been described, but I want to talk about a number of beliefs and cultural practices which are related and which are to gives the background. So I basically want to establish some themes and contexts for my presentation today. So the second part then, I will talk a little bit about Thai Maichis, so how they have been described in literature, in academic literature, and how Maichis themselves have been talking about themselves as to why they've become Maichis and what their motivations are and aspirations. So, but point one and two are more or less to give me the framework in which my presentation is to take place. That is, I want to talk about my own research that I have been pursuing over the last, I would say, 7 years or so, which is on female saints in modern Thai Buddhism. And here I want to emphasize, or one objective of my presentation today is to demonstrate the multivocality and complexity of practices, identities in relation with female Buddhist practice. Now, and here in the third part, I want to focus on two particular women and their biographies and their venerational practices. There's first of all Meshi Gao Siem Lam, and secondly, Khun Mae Bun Nguyen Tong Bun Tam. I have been studying their lives, their biographies, their hagiographies for a couple of years now, and also have published a couple of papers on their really inspiring and most interesting life stories. Now, this slide basically shows the conceptual framework in which my presentation will take place. So I will investigate female sainthood in modern Thai Buddhism. And by doing so, I will do so by looking at hagiographies and how these women are revered and what we can learn from that. And I will pay particular attention to what we may call gendered elements in their biographies or hagiographies. Now, and one central question is, and I think this was raised before in previous lectures, is what does it actually mean being ordained in the Thai context? I think this has been repeatedly discussed, not only as a part of this program, but also more widely, of course. So I try to answer these questions by analyzing their biographies. So both of these women are, and I will, of course, elaborate on that, what this actually means, revered and have been described as Ariyapukkalas. So both of them are believed to have achieved transcendental states of mind. Meti Gao Siem Lam is very often referred to as Meti Arahan. That is, she is believed to have achieved full awakening. With regard to Khun Mae Bun Nguyen Tong Bun Tam, the biographies are not that clear on this very issue, which is actually very interesting. Sometimes she's referred to as someone with the five abhinyas, but not, interestingly, not the sixth one, which would refer to, or which is about awakening. Sometimes people refer to her saying she is Ariyapukkala, but they're not very specific as to which level she or people believe she has achieved. Sometimes they say she's an anakami, meaning on the third level. Sometimes they say she's an arahan. So here, in contrast to Meti Gao Siem Lam, this is not clear, and this is quite significant for my investigation. Now, as I just explained before, I will go into the biographies of these two women in more detail. I first of all want to give some, yeah, we call it here, snapshots in order to contextualize and also establish themes that are relevant for my investigation of the lives and practice and teachings of these two women. When we look statistically at Thai Buddhism, and here I refer to the official figures, then we can say over the course of 1 year, so according to official figures, there are more than 250,000 Theravada monks, bhikkhus, and up to or more than 100,000 novices in Thailand. Of course, this figure changes over the course of a year. Very often, monks may ordain for only 3 months or even shorter, but they are still counted, they still appear in these figures. So the monks who actually stay longer, say for 5, 10, or even 20 years, they are also part of these figures, but their number is then actually much lower. Anyhow, of course, it's safe to say that there's a significant number of ordained monks and novices in Thailand. At the same time, there are probably not more than 130 Theravada nuns, bhikkhunis, and female novices. And of course, as we know, they are not officially recognized as bhikkhunis in Thailand, something that Venerable Dhammananda was talking about already in a previous lecture. And then, of course, we have between 15 to 20,000 Mechis. Here it's very problematic to give an exact figure, as they are not, unlike the monks, officially registered. And so there's also a certain fluidity here, and it's very difficult to ascertain the real figure when it comes to Mechis. I mean, I found one source that actually says, well, there are up to 40,000 Mechis in Thailand, but this number seems to be quite high. To my second snapshot. Here I want to refer to the Vedantara Chataka. I'm sure all of you are familiar with the story of the Buddha to be, the Bodhisattva Vedantara, the Buddha to be on his last life on earth in order to fulfill the 10 perfections, the 10 Balamis in his last life. Of course, he was practicing Dana. And here, he was supported by his wife, Matsi. And the scholar, Thai scholar, Subhanasatharanan, she said about this story that for centuries, the Mahachatzaman, another name here for Vedantara Chataka, has been telling Thai society how an ideal Thai wife should behave. Matsi, the wife of the Buddha, has set a standard for a totally accepting and supportive wife. The message is that Thai women should do likewise. That's her interpretation. So Matsi, of course, she was leaving the palace with Vedantara, going into the jungle, living there a very ascetic life. And then, of course, Vedantara gave away their children, and finally even Matsi was given away so that the Buddha could practice the 10 perfections. I will not go into further detail, but again, these are simply snapshots in order to provide some context and establish some of the themes that I want to investigate further later on. The anthropologist Monica Lindbergh-Falk in 2007 said, the ideal Thai woman is a dutiful daughter who is expected to marry and become a caring wife and a self-sacrificing mother. Men's ordination is highly prized, whereas women who leave the lay life deviate from Thai cultural values. And this, of course, is in contrast to the quotation in the previous slide, a depiction of women or the female body from within Thai Buddhism. Here, a mural in a Thai Buddhist temple that you will find in many temples, in most of the temples in Thailand. A very famous scene I'm sure you're all familiar with. Mara sends his 3 daughters, Tanha, Rakha, and Arati, in order to irritate the Buddha, in order to seduce the Buddha. But of course, as we know, the Buddha was not, there was no impact on his mind here, but clearly women or a female body is here taken or depicted as seducers. And this is a mural also found in a monastery, and in this case in the southern part of Thailand. The title of this mural reads Rakah Sadrumu Hen Santi, which may be translated as lust, the enemy of peace. And of course here the female body is again depicted as, well, an obstacle for male practice. Well, I should be actually be more correct. It's not the female body, but how the male mind is imagining the female body. But I will come back to this later on again. So let me move on to the next slide, which, of course, seems to have a similar message here. Again, this is I've taken this photo in a temple, famous temple in the southern part of Thailand, and here the female body again is perceived as an obstacle for the practice of men. At least when, you know, according to the comments which can be found on the back of this rather large poster, when women dress inappropriately, like in this case, according to this temple. But let me move on, and I will come back to this again. Now, in Thai, there's also saying that women are the enemy of the seven roads, Puying Ben Thakro Kong Pa Lua. And then, of course, another quotation that can be found very often, or rather often, I should say, be it in texts or in sermons, where people refer to the Iti Marang Ahmacharyatsa, so women are here said to be the stain of the holy life. And then let me move on to another one. In 2004, when a senator from the Northeast queried some signs in northern temples in the north of Thailand, whether they are actually in conflict with the 1997 constitution that, of course, guaranteed equal rights between the genders, she actually questioned these signs that, as you can see here, above on the left, women not allowed, please remove shoes, that women are not allowed to enter specific areas within monasteries. In this case, they're not allowed to get too close to the main stupa. Here, it is believed that the relic is not, as many people may think, at the spire of the stupa, but at the basis of the stupa, and therefore women are not allowed, according to this sign, to get close. And on the right-hand side, we see the ordination hall of a major temple, also in the north of Thailand, some 60 or so kilometers south of Chiang Mai. And next to the main entrance, you see a sign here, Ham Puying Kun. So again, Puying are not allowed to enter this specific part of the temple. Now, why? And when we look at a sign, the sign that is on the below, on the left corner, here actually it gives an explanation. Here it reads, Ham Namahan Tuk Chanit Kun Chanbon Let Satri Ni Patam Duan Ham Kun Duai. So this may be translated as it's forbidden to take food upstairs. This is on the second level of this monastic building. And women, during their period menstruation, are also not allowed to go upstairs. So here, this gives the explanation. So it's not because they're women, but because it's believed what is problematic is the menstrual blood. So this should not get close to the holy or sacred area or the sacred relics. And those cultural practices or beliefs also can be found elsewhere. Another form, in Thailand, sometimes you may still be able to see that there are actually two clothes lines. One is rather low, whereas the other one is, normal height. So, and the you will then see that female underwear is actually not put on the clothesline, which is maybe a little bit higher, but on a clothesline to be dry, that is lower, in order to prevent people from walking underneath it. The idea is that menstrual blood is not to be higher above your head or above amulets. So Terville explained this, these practices. Menstrual blood is deemed to be dangerous, polluting, and metrically opposed to beneficial power, like powers inserted in amulets that are believed to be magically efficacious. All substances which may come into contact with menstrual blood are thus suspects. This, again, is a temple in northern Thailand, in Chiang Mai, not far from the city center. And here you can also read on the sign that women are not allowed to get close. This, in this case, is a Lord Nam Thip, so holy or sacred water, and women should not get close here. So again, the idea is that the menstrual blood may pollute or have a negative impact on the beneficial powers of, in this case, holy water. So during menstruation, women are prohibited from entering Buddhist monasteries, especially on holy days. Now, this has been observed, but is certainly not valid for all temples and not for all temples in the northern part of Thailand, but was observed for at least some temples. And this mural, again, reflects a similar idea. This picture was taken in the famous temple Ratmaharan in Lumphun, that depicts a rather famous story about the Queen Dharma Devi. Dharma Devi, she tricked her suitor and had him wear a hat which was woven with threads that contained her menstrual blood. So this king who wanted to marry Queen Dharma Devi, he had to throw a spear from Doisu Thep in Chiang Mai to Lumphun, which is, I think, 40 kilometers or so. And he, because of his extraordinary strength, he was about to achieve that when she then gave him this hat with her menstrual blood in it. And this, of course, then made it impossible for him to achieve his task because he was suddenly felt very, very weak and had no strength left anymore. So the basic idea, again, and here I want to refer to Lindbergh Fogg, is that the notion of the uncleanness of menstruation is linked to the concept of power of women to pollute men and sacred objects. For fear of women's power to pollute and defile, restrictions are placed on women so that men and sacred objects charged with protective power do not deplete their power through contact with women's bodies. Now, the next slide here is a little bit different in that here I refer to a quotation from which I got from a text written by Gulawi, and she actually was quoting a famous monk from a temple in the north of Bangkok who reportedly said that women are the gender with least merits. They cannot be ordained and are not able to attain awakening. For these reasons, they have to create a lot of merit and make a vow so that they can be reborn as men in their next life. then they will be able to become ordained and achieve awakening and be free from dukkha. Now, Gundavi also, I have to say, argues in the very same article that these kinds of beliefs seem to be disappearing, but nevertheless, you may come across these kinds of teachings. Von Esprit, though, writes in 2000 that the idea of rebirth as a woman as a result of misdeeds in past lives is widespread in Thailand. And another quotation, men possess more merit than women, as men are able to become a bhikkhu. For this reason, men have the opportunity to experience nibbana. But women do not have the chance to become bhikkhuni. They can be ordained as a mechi only. So, and of course, within this e-learning program, you already, I understand, have been talking about the bhikkhuni ordination debate in Thailand. And I want, of course, not to go into this again, but what I want to mention here that is, of course, the discussion that has been taken place in connection with the bhikkhuni ordination debate, that people have been arguing that, well, we have mechis, and the mechis can be a substitute for the bhikkhuni. Of course, many of you make it as a rather poor substitute for bhikkhunis and would not, of course, agree with Mechis as a substitute for bhikkhuni. And, of course, those who suggested that also said, well, Mechis, the institution of Mechis needs to be improved before it can be an alternative to the bhikkhuni ordination. And again, we may revisit this later on. I simply want to mention it because it becomes relevant in my investigation of the biographies of the two female saints I want to look into later. Now, before doing so, though, I want to talk a bit about Mechis. Now, this necessarily very short overview of Mechis and, of course, problematic because I have to necessarily generalize here. This is based on my own research with Mechis and mostly Thai research, Thai sources that I have been referring to. So here I want to first talk a little bit about why Mechis have become or want to become Mechis. So, and here, of course, we have, really surprisingly, a variety of different motivations. So, some said that they want to or have become Mechis because they want to fulfill a vow. Others, though, hope to solve personal problems. Others say they want to become a Mechi in the hope to gain better access to education. Still others want to escape economic hardship or have the wish to help society or Buddhism. But there's also a significant number of Mechis, of course, who say they have become Mechi because they want to pursue the path to Nirvana. Now, of course, we have been observing many changes over the last, I would say, 20 years or maybe somewhat starting earlier, 30, 40 years. And but, of course, what we need, I believe, in order to improve the situation of Mechis is a greater, much more significant changes. But this is probably the topic of another talk. Here, I simply say that there have been many, many changes and improvements to the situation of Mechis. There were more or are more opportunities available, especially when it comes to education. The two monastic universities in Thailand Mahadula Longporn and Mahamakut both now offer courses on similar, the same courses basically they offer to monks. So we have seen a significant number of Meijis who got a BA and MA and also increasingly a PhD from these Buddhist universities. They get scholarships and get support. There are, of course, also an increasing number of Meijis who have become teachers at these universities and also very significant Abhidhamma teachers. Of course, there's still a number of quite significant imbalances between the educational or the support that Meijis receive and compared to the support that monks receive. And then, of course, very often referred to in the literature and quite important, there is a blurredness and ambiguity when it comes to legal status and official definition of Meiji, if there is any. So clearly there is a blurredness of identity, so which is also reflected in Thai language. As you may know, the monks in Thailand, they have their own monastic language, so specific words they use for personal pronouns or for specific verbs like to eat, to take a shower, and so forth. So they have their own monastic language. And when people talk with or about Meijis, then you can also very often observe this blurredness or ambiguity in that sometimes Thai people would use this monastic language for Meijis too. Sometimes they won't. So it's not very, very clear even in language itself. And then, of course, ministries in Thailand, they are also not consistent in how they deal with Meijis. So they are, for example, not allowed or had not been allowed to vote, even though I heard Meijis who said they also voted in general elections. So monks are not allowed to vote, and Meijis are not allowed to vote, because so it was argued they are ordained ones. But at the same time, monks, they receive free health care, which Meijis don't, at least not institutionally. I mean, of course, doctors may say, individual doctors or nurses may say, I treat you for free because I have respect, I have faith, and therefore I won't charge you for the treatment. But monks, because they are monks, they would automatically receive free medical treatment. And the same, of course, applies to public transport. When monks go on a bus, say, a public bus, then they would not have to pay, whereas Meijis are very often expected to pay. But again, an individual bus driver may not charge. So what I'm saying here, that again, there's this blurredness, and it's very often up to the individual as to how he, she relates to, interacts with Meijis. And at the same time, we have been observing, especially over the last, say, 10, 20 years, that there is a significant number, and I would argue an increasing number, of Meijis and female lay practitioners who have begun to set new paradigms. So most famously probably is Meiji Sansani, who is also internationally quite well known and popular, and with the fantastic work she's doing, her many social activities and creative methods of teaching the Dhamma. And she has a wonderful monastic place in the middle of Bangkok. It's a beautiful island where especially women go in order to practice meditation, to address their personal problems with the help of Meijis Sansani. and she's doing fantastic work there and has become very popular and famous in Thai society. But she's not the only one. There are, of course, other Maechis or female lay practitioners like Kun Mae Sili Grin Chai, who has a large number of followers. She's a teacher of meditation. Maechi Vimutia, who works at the Bulalongkorn University, is a Pali scholar, highly respected. And this is only to name a few. But having said that, again, when compared to monks, I think it's fair to say that that there's, despite the many changes that I was referring to and the increasing number of outstanding, highly respected Maechis and female lay practitioners, what is still lacking is what I would call here institutional charisma. So by becoming a monk, the monks automatically, through the act of ordination, through wearing the robes, have automatically this institutional charisma. So people wouldn't, for example, ask, at least not necessarily for the name of a monk before they make a donation. Simply seeing a monk in the morning, they would give automatically in the belief that this will be a way of making merit. And this is something that is based on the belief, of course, that a monk has been ordained in the lineage that was founded by the Buddha himself. And this is clearly something that is missing when it comes to Maechis. So what I'm saying here is that the white robes of Maechis do not have this on a, say, religious, cultural level, this sacredness, charisma that the robes or the monks would have, because they are not seen as in direct line of ordination that reaches back to, so it is believed, to the Buddha himself. At the same time, it has been observed that there are, especially in communities in the west of Bangkok, especially but not only in Arbori province, that there is an approximation of the roles between monks and Maechis. So where Maechis go for alms in the morning, they are living in independent nunneries, they organize their communities very similar to monastic communities of monks. They are highly respected, they give teachings, they do funeral chantings, and so forth. And there are apparently, is apparently an increasing number of independent nunneries that I just mentioned that are administered, supported, similar to the ways in which the monasteries of monks are supported and are run. But of course they are not officially monasteries, this is not possible, and so they are independent nunneries that provide space and support and give shelter and allow Maechis to practice in the Buddhist religion similarly to monks. And then what I already mentioned before, there is an increasing number of highly respected Pali and Buddhist studies and Abhidhamma scholars, Maechis, amongst Maechis, and Collins, Steve Collins and Justin and Daniel, they've written a paper on that. I, together with Maechi Pitana, we also published a paper last year, a quite extensive paper that is based on 300 interviews, also with questionnaires, on the education careers of Maechi. So there's a lot of things going on, and certainly what we can say that there is an increasing number of these outstanding scholars and Metis are doing really, really well and are becoming increasingly highly respected because of the detailed, comprehensive knowledge they have and the way they are able to convey it. And very often monks would study them with Metis. Now, so therefore, I think it's safe to argue that the situation of Metis has been improving significantly over the last 20 years in various ways. I want to summarize. We have more educated women who are ordained as Metis. And this is also, I think, because of the efforts by Metis and the support they receive. Of course, an important date here is 1969, when the Metis Institute was founded, and to provide an organization and support and to help Metis to try to establish some kind of uniform or consistent practice by coming up with clear rules, by coming up with clear rules as to how to dress, as to how to behave. And very often when we read about Metis, the way they are defined, it's that, well, Metis shave their hair, wear white robes, and follow the 8 or 10 precepts. But in fact, there are many more precepts that they follow. At the very least, they also follow the 75 Segya Vatvas, and then they have, of course, additional rules as to how to wear the robes and so forth and so forth. And this is all outlined in the a book that has been produced by the Thai Metis Institute. Then what we can also say is that Metis receive a better support of middle-class lay people who, according to the intellectual monk Papasan Visalo, day by day have a better opinion of Metis because of these individuals like Metis Damsani, Metis Nimudia, and many other Metis that have shown that Metis are very capable and worth of respect. But at the same time, these changes should, of course, not disguise the fact that, in the words of Lindbergh Ford, many Metis still live under difficult circumstances nonetheless. Today, Metis have better chances of acquiring education, and they have stipulated rules and regulations that provide a basis for their practice and for recognition as worthy religious persons by the laity and by monks. Now, let me now move on to my own research within this framework and within these many contexts. And we have seen it's extraordinarily complex because it's not only about the interpretation of the Dhamma Vinaya. There are also many cultural practices which obviously are not really related, if at all, to the Buddhist teaching, as at least as outlined in the Pali canon or the commentaries. And then, of course, we, as I've also shown, we have the extraordinarily complicated Thai political and social history we have to take into account when talking about Metis. So there are different strands which overlap and, of course, certainly influence each other to some extent. But what I'm arguing here, it's very, very complex because of these many factors we have to take into account when talking about Metis. So it's not only a Dhamma Vinaya thing, but also state power plays a role and, of course, many other religious cultural practices within Thailand or Thai Buddhism. Now, but now let me come to my own research. When you go to Thailand, I mean, it's very easy to find statues, pictures, symbols like the ones I have on this slide. Namely, you see men, highly respected and revered, like here in the middle below, you see a Longpu Man, Phulitato, who is probably one of the most influential and well-known monks of 20th century Thailand. Next to him on the left is the 19th century Saint Somdetpo, also highly influential and well-known. And then, of course, above in the left corner, you have the some of the many disciples of Longpu Man, most of whom, of course, in the meantime already passed away, but still some few are still alive, and you can see here how highly Thai people revere them and respect them. Here's, here are some further examples. So the picture above shows Pamongkorn Thepmuni Rinpoche of Wat Bak Nam, again a very significant and influential temple in the middle of Bangkok. And here you see the enormous respect that people have. And you see here a figure of him that is made of pure gold. In the left corner below you see a huge statue of Longpu Thuat, a saint believed to have lived in the Ayutthaya period. And this is a statue that had been built in the southern province of Adurb Kiri Khan. Very beautiful and very huge. And then basically in every taxi, or virtually in any taxi in Thailand, you will see symbols of or for the veneration of male saints or male practitioners. And so it's actually seemingly very difficult to find the veneration or symbols or practices for the veneration of female saints. So here's a further example. This is, and this is quite significant for what I'm going to say in a couple of minutes. Another example for the veneration of male saints. Here we have the stupa of Longpu La, a disciple of Longpu Man, whose picture you've just seen, Longpu Man Phulitato, 1870-71, who died in 1949 and is regarded as the founder of the Thai forest tradition. And he had many, many disciples, some say 800, many of whom have become themselves great masters of meditation, and some of them actually very famous, like Lord Dharma Habur or Lopu Cha, who actually has many monasteries also in the West. But what I want to talk here about and point out is the veneration of these saints as expressed in the building of stupa museums. So, and they look to many of them actually very similar. So you find most of them in the northeast of Thailand, in the north of Thailand. There are not so many in other parts of Thailand. It's of course partly explained because of the fact that the tradition really developed in the northeast and the north of Thailand. The idea here is that when a saint passes away and his body is cremated, very often the biographies contain very similar stories. What then happens is that after cremation, the bones are distributed and are kept in urns. And then at one point, people realize when opening the urns and they see that bones have become crystals, so that a transformation has taken place So bones turned into these crystals, and this is then believed to be the manifestation or evidence for sainthood, like you see here on this picture in the right corner below, where you see bone fragments in the middle of this stupa, mostly on the first level. And visitors are really invited to study these bones. Sometimes, if a monk is around, he may actually invite you to hold a bone, or may even provide you with a magnifier so that you can really study and look at these crystals that are believed to be, you know, some kind of, as Gabod put it, scientific evidence of the sainthood of these monks. So this is mostly placed on the first level of the stupa, together with the wax figure of the saint, and you also very often have within the stupa signs that contain significant episodes in the biography of the saint. And then, as you can see here too, on the left picture below, the things that the monk had been using, like his robes, his armor, and so forth, are kept in a museum, and for people to come and study and get inspired. And so these are very, very interesting buildings, which you can find in many of the monasteries of the forest tradition. And when you go into bookstores in Thailand, what you certainly find is in many, if not all, of the bookstores are books like these, bestsellers, really. For example, the book on the left is titled is Palahan Ni Ding. Palahan do really exist. Sayam Prathet, Mai Wang Dat Pa Alahan. Sayam or Thailand is not devoid of Palahan, so fully awakened beings. And in the book, of course, you will find then biographies or summaries of biographies of monks. And as you can see here nicely with the book on the left, Lobu Man as the father of the false tradition, as the ultimate teacher at the top, and then below him, his either direct disciples or disciples of a second generation. And in this case, at least when I was doing research, some of these monks had still been alive. At least two of them had passed away in the meantime. So this book has been reprinted many times. This is the sixth impression. Now the book on the right has been reprinted seven times, and it has become a bestseller, which you can still find in most bookstores in Thailand. Its title is Minathi Manuttam Parahan Mitting. So the moment of attainment, the moment of achieving the Dhamma, Arahan, fully awakened being, do still exist. And again, this book would contain biographies or the short version of it, in this case describing the very moment of attaining Aryabhukala status, be it Sotapanna, Anagami, or then ultimately, of course, Arahan. So I've shown in the last couple of slides that it's the veneration of male practitioners believed to be have been very successful, believed to have become Aryabhukala on various stages like Sotapanna or Sakadagami, Anagami, or very often also in these cases Arahan. They're all around in Thailand, in bookstores, in museums, as amulets, and so forth and so forth. And that, of course, raises the question, is there no veneration of female practitioners? Well, obviously, my answer is already known to you, given the title of my presentation today. There are female saints in Thai Buddhism. And this is what I want to talk about now. Now, I think you're already familiar, if I remember correctly, Lord Dhammananda already has shown you a picture of these 52 bhikkhuni in the Bangkok monastery, that Pidaram, which was built by Rama III, and obviously depicts bhikkhunis in this part of the temple. So here we have representations of successful female practice in Thailand. And then, of course, also very famously, and I already mentioned her, Queen Dharmateri. Here you see a statue of her in the middle of the northern town of Lumpur, and you can see here how highly revered she is. It's quite obvious from this picture. So, as Donald Sverra observed, people would go there, devotees, and present offerings of flowers, candles, and incense, and respectfully kneel before Dharmateri's heroic standing image, much as devotees venerate the image of the Buddha. Another example is this. This is in the town center of the rather large city of Koh Rat, which is in the northeast of Thailand. The veneration of this woman, Thao Suthanali, is also quite obvious here. So Thao Suthanali is believed to have been instrumental in quelling a rebellion in the 1820s during the time of Rama III, and she again is highly revered, as you can see here. People would kneel in front of her image, make donations, and I have no better word for that now, pray to her. But, of course, the pictures that I've shown to you, these women are either canonical figures, like in the case of Wattepidaram, the 52 bhikkhunis, and you may find other temples in Bangkok or in the north where you see depiction statues of bhikkhunis. But these are, of course, canonical figures. And then the other examples that I have shown to you, Queen Dharmateri or here Thao Suthanali, are, of course, women who are revered because of their achievements as heroines rather than as female practitioners. Of course, Dharmateri, you will find depictions where she is depicted towards the end of her life as a Meshi, but as far as I know, she has never, at least on a significant scale, been revered as someone who has been successful in terms of spiritual attainments. She has been revered, I believe, because she was quite successful as a queen. So, then again the question, are there then no female Thai saints in modern Thai Buddhism? Obviously there are. And this is what now I want to talk about by studying the two female saints that are introduced at the beginning of my presentation. So this is now based on my own ethnographic work and the analysis of the biographies that I have been collecting over the last 8 years or so. So again, I want to investigate in the following what we can learn from these biographies in terms of female sainthood in modern Thai Buddhism, what it means to be ordained for these women, and of course for those followers, or those who have belief in or faith in these women, and what we can learn from that in terms of gender relations. So both when look at how these women themselves see themselves as in relation to monks, and how they have been perceived by lay or by academics. And this is what I want to investigate. And of course, I have to say it's so complex, these relations, gender relations, and scholars, of course, have been debating it for years and years and years, and there are lots of quite divergent arguments that have been put forward. And I'm certainly will not be able to decide anything here, but I simply want to add by investigating these biographies, which so far I think have been not been given the attention they certainly deserve. As I have argued elsewhere, I mean, it's very regrettable, in fact, that the lives and sociopolitical impact of these women have not sufficiently been considered in scholarly discussions so far when it comes to gender inequality or the community debate in Thailand. But I think this is really necessary if we want to gain a clearer and more comprehensive picture of the complexities of the roles of women in Thai society. Now, let me start now with the short overview of the life of Metty Gersiablam. What I want to emphasize here is that I do not attempt to reconstruct how her life was. That's not my intention. And what I want to understand is how her life has been understood. So how the biographies have been developed and how people have, the biographers or those who have taken these biographies as a source for inspiration, how they have been understanding her life. This is my concern, at least for the presentation of today. Now, Metty Gersiablam was born in 1991 in what is today the northeastern province of Mukdahan. She was born into a small village and into the ethnic group of Pu Thai. So she actually did not speak Thai, or at least not standard Thai, but Pu Thai, which is actually very difficult to understand. It took me a long time to figure out a specific phrase when I was reading her texts. That have come to us. There are not many, unfortunately, in her case. There are some that have been orally transmitted amongst her female disciples. So luckily, we still have some of her teachings. But these texts are really difficult to understand because of this dialect. Now, from a very young age, she was able to recollect former lifetimes. I mean her biographies, and there are actually quite a number of biographies on her life. They are full of these supernatural occurrences, that she was able to recollect former lives, or that she was able to have conversations with spirits, could see nagas, could travel through Buddhist cosmology, and so forth. As a girl, she, according to her biography, she could go to the monastery only with her parents. And she had to sit far away from monks because of her gender. In contrast to boys, who are normally encouraged to sit close to monks, and very often, of course, parents are very happy if a monk touches their son. But of course, in the case of girls, this is quite the opposite. From a very young age, Thai people would ensure that there's a clear physical distance between men and women. Now, she had these experiences and was able to recollect former lives and so forth, but she was encouraged not to talk about it because people may have thought then that she is crazy. But this changed then in 1917 when she, her local communities was visited by a number of monks of the forest tradition, Long Bu Man himself here on the right, and Wu Zhao. They visited the local community and they were staying there with numerous other monks while, and Long Bu Man himself, he, according to these biographies, paid a lot of attention to the spiritual progress of Meiqi Gao. He was giving her individual instructions in meditation and was praising her and actually said that she has done an extraordinary progress in meditation. She had really significant unique paths on an outstanding level. So she clearly has enormous progress with the help of Long Bu Man himself. But when the great teachers had to leave, then finally, the local community, the biographies report then what happened next in this way, namely Long Bu Man is reported to have said that if you were a boy, I would have ordained you as a novice so that you could have come with me. But since you're a girl, accompanying me would be difficult with regard to the Dhamma Vinaya. Stop practicing meditation. This is what the biographies tell. There are slightly variations in what he said or the wording of it, and also in the interpretation of that. Some say, for example, that he advised her not to continue with meditation because without, because of her mind that is so powerful, this can be actually quite harmful to her. So she, he actually wanted her to wait for the right teacher to give her advice on how to deal with this extraordinarily powerful mind of her. And this was the reason why he advised her not to continue with meditation. But clearly, because of her gender, she was then not able to become a novice and to become one of his disciples. I think this is something that we can clearly conclude from this episode. Now, and this, of course, changed her life quite significantly. Even though she was not interested in married life, she was married at the age of 17. They had never children of their own. They adopted a girl whose name was Gao, and this was also the reason why she then was called Ma Gao, the mother of Gao, and then later on Meiqi Gao, her real name actually being Da Bai. She never lost her interest in meditation and the Buddhist religion. She wanted to become a Meiqi, but her husband didn't allow that. Only after relatives helped her, she was finally allowed in 1937 to become a Meiqi in the local temple. First it was agreed that she will stay there only for 3 months, but then she simply did not disrobe and continued being a Meiqi. It's a very long and interesting story, actually. But if you're interested, you can read this up in my paper on her life. It gives a short summary of this episode. But for us, it's important that she continued then with her meditation and had, again, these many supernatural occurrences, but did not make any significant progress in terms of being closer to Nirvana. This changed only in 1950, so 1 year after the death of Long Bu Man, when she finally meets Long Dama Habua, one of the most famous disciples of Long Bu Man, who then became actually her teacher, and he gave her then again individualized teachings to show you a picture of the importance of Lungtham Mahabua. He was the king of Thailand and the queen of Thailand. He, Lungtham Mahabua, passed away in 2011, and it's fair to say, I think, that he's probably one of the most influential and well-known monks in Thai Buddhism. So following his instructions, she then turned away literally from the outside. So he basically, Lungtham Mahabua criticized Maitri Gao's practice in that she was interested in the outside, meaning these supernatural occurrences too much, and not paying enough attention to the inside. And she was also, according to the biographies, quite stubborn at first, and Lungtham Mahabua had to be quite tough for her, made her actually cry, and then she turned around and then followed the instructions of her teacher. And this is what happened then on the 1st of September of 1952, according to her biographies. Whilst resting from practicing walking meditation, she felt tired from having done walking meditation for the whole night and therefore sat down on a bamboo platform under her yam tree to get some rest. While inclining in order to lie down and thinking, I will rest for a moment and then go and rise for the monks, she perceived a rumbling noise as if lightning was hitting the platform on which she was resting. At the same time, there was a noise saying the rebirths had come to an end. Her tears were flowing copiously in joy. This is regarded as the moment that she achieved full awakening. And here on the picture, you see the spot this people believe is where it happened. And here you can see the place where she practiced walking meditation. And of course, this is now not to be used any longer. Many of the places significant in her biographies and in her memory in Mukdahan, in the village she was born, are now fenced off so that people cannot actually use it any longer because it was used by her and had these places had enormous importance in her biography. But clearly this shows the extraordinary respect and veneration that is given to her. This is now her nunnery in Mukdahan. This picture was taken a couple of years ago. This shows how highly revered she is. And it's a very beautiful place, by the way, and if you have any chance to go there, I would highly recommend it. It's one of the most impressive places in Thailand I've ever been to. Now, what is important to us, after her awakening, she then lived for nearly another 40 years, during which she traveled in Thailand, gave teachings, not on a large scale though. She was not really well known during her lifetime. She was highly respected amongst the local villagers, and of course monks of the forest tradition would know her. But she, during her lifetime, so it seems, she was not venerated as an arahant, as a fully awakened one. During the last decade of her life, she was suffering from severe medical problems. So she had, amongst other things, cancer, and then died in 1991. And what is then significant for us here is that something very similar to the biographies of male saints is what then happened. The body was cremated, and quite interestingly, Mahabua, he said it's not necessary to make funeral chantings because, so he argued, she has done for herself enough. This seems to imply, given that these funeral chantings normally take place in order to generate merit, in order to influence better rebirth, it seems to imply that, for her, it's not necessary because obviously she is awakened, she will not be reborn. Her bones have then been distributed after the cremation, which took place in her nunnery and was attended by very many monks of the forest tradition. And again, after a while, these bones crystallized, which made them manifest and clear that she was an awakened one. And this is the reason why, as you can see on this picture, in 1996, so some 5 years after her death and cremation, this deity, a stupa, was built for her. And I happened to find this by chance when I was with a friend of mine driving through the northeast of Thailand, visiting these temples, and then I came into this temple, which is in Sakhonakorn province, Akba Gelchumpun, which is the temple of another famous disciple of Lobuman, Lobu Zingtong. And then I found, to my surprise, this very building. And I was very, very happy when I read the sign in front of it, as you can see here. It basically says, well, this is the stupa of Meji Gel Siam Lam. And I'm pretty sure that this is the very first stupa ever built in Thailand for a female practitioner in modern Thai Buddhism. So as I argued before, as I said before, we have, of course, places of veneration for female practitioners who are believed to have been successful, but then we're talking about canonical figures. So here we have, I believe, for the first time in Thai history, a building that very powerfully and also, I believe, very beautifully expresses the belief that this particular woman has been successful in her practice. This edifice, the building of it, cost almost 2 million Thai baht, which is a quite a large amount of money. But of course, more important here, it expresses the belief and faith that people have had in Meji Gel. When entering the building, you will find this. There's a picture of her in front of which there's this urn with, again, bones of her. And as you may see here, these bones have become crystallized and therefore give evidence of her spiritual achievement. And then a couple of years later, in 2006, the sept stupa has been completed for her. And as you can see here, it's much bigger, much larger, in front of the nunnery in Mukdahan. This park and stupa cost 30 million Thai baht. And similar to what we've seen before, and similar to many stupa museums of monastic disciples of Lobu Man, here we have a museum in the basement, which you can see on the right-hand side, the figure of her, the white figure, she practicing, showing her practicing walking meditation. And then you can see above on the right-hand side, again, an urn, a glass urn, and people are invited to study these bones that have become quite clearly crystals. And then, of course, also the next figure of her on the first floor, and a sign informing the visitor about her life, the most important episodes, and also giving the opportunity to meditate in front of her wax figure here. And what is quite clear, this stupa is called Duparaha Pukkala, or she's called Duparaha Pukkala. So a person who is worthy of a stupa, making quite explicit that she is believed to be to have been an Arahant. And here you can see to the right and left of the figure, these urns. And again, you are invited to lean over and look at these crystals, these bones, in order to study and, of course, be inspired And at the same time, explained that this stupa has been built. One of our objectives is, of course, the veneration of Maiti Gao itself, but it's also to encourage women to pursue the path towards Nibbana. Now, what is quite interesting, when I was asking people who were involved in the construction of the stupa as to the design and so forth, a very interesting story emerged. Now, there was initially a discussion as to where the relics should be placed. I mean, normally in these cases, at least a significant part of the relics of the saint venerated in these stupas is then placed in the spire, so at the top of the stupa. Here you can see the golden spire on the top. And in this case, what is very interesting is that there are relics, but these relics are actually not her relics. These relics are relics believed to be relics coming from disciples of the Buddha or disciples of Longpu Man, so modern time saints. When I asked where her relics are, it was explained to me that her relics, despite initial plans to also place them in the spire, were then finally placed underneath her figure that we can see here on the left. And then I was asking why was this done? Why did her relics placed or put into the relic container in the spire of the stupa? And then it was explained to me that here we have two levels of satta. That is Paramatta satta and Samuddhi satta. On a Paramatta level, of course, so it was argued, she is awakened, and there's no difference in the awakening anyway. It's genderless. So it has been overcome, transcended any ideas of gender, and therefore this is not relevant at all. But on a Samuddhisattva level, on a conventional level, there are still these, sensitivities in society, and therefore it was decided not to put her relics in the top of the stupa, but keep it on a lower level. And this, so it was then further explained, also reflects her own practice. Maiti Gao always made sure that she's below monks, and that she never challenged hierarchies, and she was quite careful. And another reason was this is to reflect the Garudhammas, or at least one of them, namely the first, the gender hierarchy that is to be expressed and preserved in this building. Nonetheless, when the relics were enshrined in the stupa in 2006, there was a huge number of monks, I think several hundreds, I think 400 or so, and very many Maitis and very, very many lay people coming to this event. And you can see here the enormous respect that monks have and show for Maiti Gao. Here you see Pa'adan Intawai, who belongs with, in the meantime, one of the most famous monks of the forest tradition in the northeast of Thailand. And here, similarly to what we've seen before, here you have the museum where people can study her life. They're looking at the things that she had been using, her glasses, the books she had been using, the robes, and so forth and so forth. Or even her toothbrush is preserved to inspire faith, and of course to show how simple she lived and how authentic a life she was living. And around the stupa you have this really beautiful park that invites the visitor to contemplate and to meditate, and everywhere of course it's made quite explicit that she is believed to have achieved full awakening. So what is quite interesting, and I already indicated this already, is that during her lifetime, actually, she was not really well known. Only amongst her local community, of course, she was known, and she was highly respected as someone who was pursuing a good practice. People were not referring to her as an enlightened one or awakened one. She was simply someone they had respect for because of her ascetic lifestyle. And she was not known at all beyond the local community and beyond some of the monks of the forest tradition who may have met her or who may have heard about her. Reporters from magazines on the supernatural from Bangkok visited her and asked her to talk about her, about her supernatural abilities and so forth. She did not do so. She was not interested in becoming famous. She was, so it seems, interested in living remote life and pursuing consistently her practice right until her death. But this changed with her death, or more precisely after her death, with the crystallization that I was mentioning already of her bones. And this is very interesting in that when she died, and after cremation, and the bones were then distributed at various places, a large part went up further north to a monastery of Lumpur in Tawai. And then you had these crystallization, and then they were further distributed, these bones. Meiji Gale suddenly became accessible at various places in Thailand at the same time, in her bones. So, here I want to quote Ray, who observed something similar in connection with the saints of early Buddhism, saying while they were alive, the saints often have been relatively inaccessible. They spent much of time in remote places, so same like Meiji Gale. But when the saints had passed beyond and the relics were enshrined in stupas, they finally became available to all and could become the object of an ongoing cult. And I would argue that this happened also in the case of Meiji Gale. So over the last years, and I'm still doing that, I've been trying to find where her relics, her bones, actually went to in Thailand, and I found very many places. Like the picture above on the left, this is in Ban Tat, the monastery of Luang Tam Mahabua, where you can see these little urns in which you find very systematically at display the crystallized bones of saints, starting off, of course, with the Buddha himself, and then in a chronological order, you know, you find the bones of Pasalibut, Moggallana, and so forth, and then, of course, of later saints of the tradition of the Theravada tradition, and then, of course, going to the saints of the 20th century, Lopu Sao, Lopu Man, Busing Tong and so forth. And here I also found then, of course, the bones or relics of Meiji Gale. And similarly, when I went to Wati Li Luang, one of the most important Thammayut temples in the northern part of Thailand, I found also a relic collection behind the main stupa in Wati Li Luang. And here you find the picture on the left below, quite systematically, a collection of these disciples of Luang Pu Man, most of them, and amongst which also you will find the relics of Meiji Gale Xian Lam. So during her lifetime, obviously you had only one Meiji Gale, but now you have many representing her, and obviously also making evident and manifest her achievement, her full awakening. And here even as pictures, that people would take pictures of her bones or relics and then would reveal them. You will find also these relics online, and there are various relic museums in Thailand, one of which is in Chiang Mai, where you will find her relics at display. And again, when I went there, I was even asked whether I want to hold her relics in my hand in order to study the bones. I was given a magnifier, and I was asked to look at the crystallization of the bones. Now, and therefore we can observe, I think, something that is very similar to the relics of the Buddha himself, where, as Strong argued, relics are also extension of the Buddha's biography. It's first possible to think of this as an assertion of the ongoing presence of the Buddha, but it's preferable to think of it as the further development of a powerful narrative. And I think this is certainly the case in Nettie Gao's biography, that are actually going beyond her death. Her paradigm-setting example was actually much more effective post-mortem through the crystal relics than when she was alive. Or as Scharf observed a couple of years ago, there is in fact considerable evidence that the mobility of relics contributed to the success of Buddhism as a missionary religion. And I think something similar is happening here, in that the success of the story or veneration of paradigm setting of Maggie Gale was to a large extent, I believe, possible because of the mobility, because of the fact that you have, in theory at least, an endless number of relics, and they are, of course, portable and can be taken and venerated at various places, even in private houses and so forth, and therefore inspire. And this is at least one important factor in the story unfolding, the postmodern story unfolding, or as Strong puts it here, this powerful narrative that is still being written. Like, for example, expressed on this poster that I found in Bad in the monastery of Lungpa Mahabur, where you can see the sayings of the forest tradition, starting off with Dokun Ubali, Lungpu Sao, Lungpu Man. And then at the end, on the right hand side below, you can see then Mechi Gao Siam Lam. Obviously, still preserving the hierarchy, because clearly this is not in a chronological order, but it's because of gender. But she is one, she's regarded to be one of the saints of the forest tradition. And this is in line with many publications, recent publications of the forest traditions. You have an increasing number of books on relics, quite systematically discussing relics, when they emerged, how they look like, what we can learn from them. And you have an increasing number now of books that also contain pictures and stories of Meiji Gao, and in the meantime also other Meijis. She's certainly one of the famous, most famous, if not the most famous Meiji within the forest tradition, but not the only one, as I will show in a publication. There are actually quite a large number of Meijis within the forest tradition who are believed to have achieved full awakening or other levels of Arya Bukkala. And similarly, they have biographies, we have veneration of relics, like the building of stupas. They are at the very least one or two other Meijis within the Thai forest tradition who are people have or want to build stupas for. And I think we will probably see more of these stupas for Meijis. And also quite interesting, when I went to visit this temple Ratnamathon. This is the temple of the late Prasankara, from the Prasankara, so the Thai Supreme Patriarch of Thailand, passed away last year. In the middle of the temple, of this temple near Pattaya, you find this building, Aryakan, so the Garag of the Arya, so the building of the noble ones, in which you find wax figures of Longpu Sao, Longpu Man, and so forth, of the forest tradition, but also you find a figure of Meiji Gao. In fact, it was Supreme Patriarch who supported the building of the stupa for Meiji Gao in her home village. He even gave the name to the stupa that contained the triple jam, meaning the stupa representing the triple Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. So I, of course, refer to this here because it shows that this Meiji Gao Xianlam is also alive, celebrated even by the highest ranking monk in Thailand, the Supreme Patriarch himself. Now, I argued that Meiji Gao's hagiographies and the veneration of her can be understood as an actualization and localization of Pali canonical ideas. Her episodes in life very often resemble, very closely actually, Buddhist narrative, the biography of the Buddha himself, when it comes to having, for example, final words by Jima Raja, or the organization of the cremation, or then, of course, the distribution of relics and so forth, the occurrences of supernatural things during the cremation. And there are very many elements in Meiji Gao's own biography that are very similar to those of the Buddha himself, or of other saints of the Pali canon, or modern Thai saints. However, similar to the Pali canon, it cannot be denied that there is also multivocality that is because of her gender. So, of course, multivocality, what I have here in mind is Sponberg's article. So we can also perceive different attitudes towards women in her biography. I mean, as I just said, she was not able to go into the temple. She was not able to pursue her meditation because of her gender. She wasn't able to become a novice of Lumpurman. She only had to wait for another 20 years or so before she finally, and only because of the support of relatives, was able to become a Meiji then. And clearly because of her gender, it was more difficult for her to practice and to find a teacher. That was not easy at all. Now, at the same time, when reading these biographies, they make all very coherently clear that overcoming internal mental defilements has much greater significance than fighting against or rising above gender inequality and the existing social disadvantages connected to it. The struggles Meiji Gao had to face as a consequence of her gender are depicted as quite minor and rather insignificant when compared to the task of realization of sainthood. She herself reportedly never thought about becoming a bhikkhuni, believing that Meiji was perfectly sufficient for her own practice. From what we know from her biographies, she was actually quite supportive of maintaining these gendered hierarchies in order to uphold traditional values that she regards as important, and is also, as I mentioned, expressed in the architecture of the stupa itself. Now, let me briefly come to my next saint that I want to talk about in a very different environment, actually, Metsi Ger, as I just explained, was living in the northeast of Thailand and is associated with the Thai forest tradition. In contrast to that, I want to talk about the biography and life and venerational practices of Khun Mae Bunnuen Tongkun Term, who is certainly one of the most interesting religious figures in 20th century Thailand, not only because of her gender, but for a variety of other reasons. She was born in 1895. Forgive me, there's a mistake. I only spotted this after I sent the PowerPoint to Venerable Ananayo. So it should read 1895 and not 1894. Her father was a gardener. She was born into a poor family. She became interested in Buddhism at a very early age, similar to Metsi Ger Siam Lam. She was listening to the Dhamma teachings of Luang Pa Phring, who was a very famous monk in the north of Bangkok in the monastery Wat Mang Pakor. And she became inspired by his teachings, and she also, so the biographies say, tell us, from a very early age, had this very strong altruism. She studied Thai traditional massage because she was interested in helping people, wanted to cure them. And she later on became then a Metsi in the famous and very important Bangkok monastery Wat Sam Pan Thawang, where she practiced following the meditation instructions of the high-ranking monk Kamaha Rajamangkala Ajahn, who gave her instructions on a daily basis. He was teaching women for more than an hour every day. So what is quite interesting about her life is actually that she, in contrast maybe to Metsi Ger, is not so much revered because it is believed that she was actually an Aliya Bukkala. She's much more revered for her healing powers, for her supernatural powers, and for her altruism. She is believed to have achieved the five apinyas. I mean, it's very interesting when studying her biographies, often it's saying she had developed or achieved the apinyas, but it's not specific as to which of these apinyas, higher knowledges, she achieved. Sometimes it says she achieved the five apinyas. Sometimes, in some biographies, it's quite explicitly saying she achieved the six apinyas, all of them, meaning she also achieved the asavakaya yana apinya, which means she was fully awakened. But in contrast to the biographies of Metsi Ger Siam Lam, this is not really given the attention one might think it would deserve, that she actually achieved full awakening. Her biographies give us a lot of detail about her healing techniques, how she used her supernatural powers, her divine eye, for example, to heal people. And what is also interesting about her biography is there's not actually one biographer, but there were many biographers who contributed. I call this in my article about her a cumulative biography, because when there were rumors that Mae Bunnuen, because of her meditation, had developed these many supernatural powers, a high-ranking monk asked witnesses to come forth and write down anecdotes in order to give evidence for these healings. And a large number of people submitted short, sometimes only a couple of lines, long anecdotes of their personal encounter with Mae Bunnuen and how she healed them using her supernatural powers. Very often, seemingly uncurable diseases were healed by her. And there's a very interesting text that was, I believe, probably first published in 1964 for her funeral. That this text is the result of an effort of lots of people. And I think these narratives actually are one of the reasons as to why she has become so powerful as a saint in Thai life, because there were so many people giving evidence for her supernatural powers. And what you can also see on this picture, on these pictures in the middle, above you see the relics of her. Again, you have, in her case, a crystallization, which, quite interestingly, there are reports that this crystallization has taken place right at the cremation of her body, which took place in 1964 in the Bangkok temple of Wat Tap Hong. And apparently, according to some accounts, there was an explosion of relics while her body was cremated there. And also very interesting, and here I want to refer back to what I said earlier about women and amulets, right? Their polluting powers. Here, the opposite is the case. She produced 100,000 of these amulets, so-called puto noi, which were given away for free initially for those who made donations to the specific temple in Bangkok. And in the meantime, they have become very highly sought after items. So some of these amulets, depending on the size of it, amongst other things, are worth up to 400,000 Thai baht on the booming amulet market. And as you can see here on these pictures, this goes even further, that amulets of her, depicting her, have been produced and are worn. The picture on the left shows her relics venerated in a temple in the north of Bangkok in Wat Sangkathan. Sometimes people would carry pictures of her, also believing that even the pictures of her have protective or healing powers. Here's some books showing the veneration of her. On the right, you see the sala, the pavilion or shrine that had been built for her in the Bangkok temple Wat Arut, also quite a famous temple. And people, since her death in the 1960s, had been going there on every Sunday and praying to her, invoking healing powers in front of her images, reciting texts in Pali, practicing meditation. There are reports of people who have been doing so, nimittas of her. On the left above you see, again in Wat Sangkathan, shrine built for her, and underneath of the shrine you see, you know, this paste, this pinkish paste, that is still produced in line with her recipes, and is placed underneath her statues because it's believed that magically efficacious powers are transferred onto this paste and then can be taken in order to cure various illnesses. Even in the temple where she initially practiced as a Maitri Vatsampanthavo with her teacher, Pramaharata Mangalajan, you see statues of her here on the left next to other significant figures, Pali canonical figures or monks of in Thai Buddhism. This is a shrine now that I found in a nunnery that is built right next, still within the compound of the temple Wat Sampanthavo, where you can see how highly revered she is, and that she is still very much, even after 50 years after her death, now so highly revered. And it seems, on an increasing scale, in fact. So there are more people building statues like that, or want amulets of her, which is the reason why, despite a rather high number of 100,000, they catch up to 400,000 Thai baht. So they're highly sought after, and there was even, I think, 2 or 3 years ago, one of the major Thai TV channels produced a documentary on her life, which was broadcast. So it seems that similar to Maxi Gale, she too has become increasingly well-known and popular. But maybe in contrast to Maxi Gale's biography, Maybunlun Dongkundam had already been quite famous during her lifetime. She had very many monks who had been her followers. She had been giving extensive sermons, which I can say are really, really profound indeed, despite the fact that she was not able to really read and write. So she must have had an extraordinary memory and has learned from monks by listening to them. So this is the way that she acquired and built up her knowledge. So I think I have to come to an end now. So Maxi Gale and Maybunlun Dongkundam both are often now, but maybe not often, are sometimes, I would say, referred to in the current discussion about epiphany ordination as an example for women who can successfully practice despite the absence of Theravada bhikkhunis. Maybunlun, even though she is highly revered because of her supernatural and healing powers and her altruism and her very, very impressive teachings that reflect a very deep and thorough and comprehensive understanding of the Pali canon and commentary texts. There are also quite clearly enormous amount of similarities to canonical and post-canonical figures. So it's simply not as emphasized, I would argue, as it is in the case of Maxi Gale. But they are there. I mean, you have these moments of awakening. You have when she, for example, leaves her home and becomes a Maxi. The way it is described, it reminds one of the night the Buddha left the palace. So the narrative, again, is very similar to what we know from other sayings of within Theravada Buddhist scripture. But in contrast to Maxi Gale, so far, as far as I'm aware of, no one has built a stupa for her. But I even found in 7-Eleven shops now her biography that can be bought there together with an amulet depicting her. So let me come to my conclusions. What I want to argue here, based on what I said about the biographies of these certainly very interesting and outstanding female practitioners. I would certainly agree with Collins and McDaniel when they argued that the idea of Maxi's life is beautiful, with meticulous and inspiring pedagogy, sophisticated and meditative expertise as goals and values per se, with intrinsic virtue as well as instrumental value in reducing suffering and leading to nirvana, has not been emphasized enough in the existing literature, which tends too often to concentrate on the issue of bhikkhuni ordination, and more generally to focus on Maxi's hardships, which are of the many, and is not denied here, and on discrimination in the Thai ecclesia. And this also, and here I want to especially refer to what I said about gender hierarchy in the biographies of Maxi Gale, but also lots of evidence for that can be found in the biographies of Maybunlun Dongkundam, but it certainly is expressed or confirmed what Joanna Cook found in the monastery she lived and worked in, she was also ordained as a Medici, I think for 1.5 years, she argued in her book published in 2010 that for Medici's, the rationale of monastic practice is never understood in terms of the systems to male authority over the equality of women vis-à-vis men. The hierarchy of gender prevalent in the monastery she worked and lived in is effectively sidestepped by the Medici's and monks through ascetic practice. They thereby employ the ideals of sociological inclusiveness without engaging in either institutional anthrocentrism or ascetic misogyny. While such views are present in the monastery and reflect the spatial separation, hierarchical duty, and domestic performance, they are understood as irrelevant to the non-gendered narrative of spiritual achievement. Of course, again, she is referring to the ideas of Sponberg, and I can only confirm here what she is arguing and saying in my own work on these biocracies. So, of course, it's not saying that these practices and beliefs that I introduced to some extent at the beginning of this talk are not there. They are there, certainly, and they have an impact, a significant impact. But for these women themselves, it's in line with what Cook here argued, not their major concern. So it's here, the rhetoric, the narratives are clearly about sociological inclusiveness. And I only last week found this quotation in the biography written, biography of Lungpo Man written by Lungpa Mahabur, which I think nicely reflects this idea. When he says, monks are especially vulnerable to the sounds of the opposite sex. If the samadhi is not strong enough, concentration can easily be destroyed. I must apologize to women everywhere because my intention here is not to criticize women in any way. It is the unsuccessful meditator that I'm addressing here so that he may arouse mindfulness as an antidote to counter these influences and not merely surrender meekly to them. Now, I do, of course, not argue here that there are no misogynistic views or practices in time. There certainly are, without any doubt, as I've shown at the beginning. But what I'm arguing here is, first of all, that it's very complex, and at least according to the biographies that I've been studying over the last 7 years, that... it seems to be that for these monks and nuns, it was the Dhamma. Gender, of course, is an issue, but the categories they talk is Dhamma rather than gender. Gender is to be overcome on the way to awakening. So thus, I want to summarize finally Mabundulan's hagiographies and, of course, hagiographies of other female saints that I have been studying, and her veneration demonstrate once more that scholars must not overlook the biographies of individuals in trying to provide a more ethnographically accurate picture of Thai Buddhism. Even though the study of institutional history is important in understanding Thai Buddhism, in itself, it's unable to explain and do justice to life stories, beliefs in, and the veneration of Buddhist practitioners like Mabundulan and many others. Mabundulan not only established herself in many areas of Thai Buddhism that are invariably ascribed to an exclusively male-dominated domain, but also succeeded in inspiring and receiving the support of individuals from established Buddhist institutions. Her life shows the complexity of concepts and relations of power in modern Thai Buddhism and seeks to defy generalized and oversimplified descriptions of gender relations and hierarchies. So I think we are only beginning to understand the enormous complexities that are going on, and we have to be very careful in keeping them apart, these different explanation, cultural practices, and of course practices that claim to be Buddhism, but may not, certainly are not justified from a canonical perspective, but may be based more on other cultural practices and beliefs. So This is where I want to end. But finally, this is what I want to give to you. Not the real ones, of course, but the amulets made by Mabelu and Dompendum. And yeah, thank you. Are there any? Yes, of course. I mean, it would certainly be interesting to also interview Pikunis or Metis, Pikunis who had been Metis for a long time and since then are ordained as Pikunis, and to compare and speak about the difference between the two vehicles without any doubt. And if I have the time, I certainly want to do that. But at the moment, I mean, my research is clearly to give more voice to these women. This is, of course, not to suggest anything in relation to the Pikuni ordination debate in Thailand. It's far from it, but it's still, at the same time, still relevant, I believe, because it allows a better and clearer understanding of women in Thai Buddhism. So what I think we should move away from is a rather, I'm not saying that this done by many scholars, but at least it seems that sometimes in these discussions there's a quite simplistic view, and when it comes to depicting the Sangha and the relationship between Sangha and women, I think we have to study more individual stories and biographies in order to understand better, rather than only focusing on institutional history. And for example, these women, these two, and I have, of course, more example for that, have been really supported by high-ranking monks and had access to the Dhamma and were highly respected for their achievements, and even by monks, who, of course, would not prostrate in front of them, but would still have huge respect for them. I, for example, two or three years ago, I was interviewing an abbot of a temple in which a highly respected Meiji, a famous meditation teacher, lives, and he said, of course she prostrates in front of me, but she is my teacher, I respect her, and it's because of her that I am here and monk and do the work that I'm doing. So these stories and these relationships and these biographies and these practices have to be studied in order to get a fuller understanding of these very complex relationships. Yes, the biography of Meiji Gao is available in English, and actually have it here. It's quite interesting. This is, again, what I said, that I do not argue here that these women have never been around. Actually, from all the research that I've done, it seems that we have had for a long time, rather long time, I mean, I found evidence for these outstanding, respected Meiji teachers already in the 1860s, if not earlier, you know, where Meijis have acquired this enormous knowledge and have had many disciples, Meiji disciples, or even monks, you know, either disciples that are supportive of these Meijis. So this, what has changed is the scale or the degree to which these Meiji have been more celebrated on a larger scale, like probably most clearly visible in the case of Meiji Gelsing Lam. During her lifetime, she was not well known at all. But then after her death, through her relics, she became then very, very famous, and the building of stupas, and then most recently, these translations or compilations of her biographies and translations into English, which now have been distributed all over the world. They were sent to America, to Canada. I got my biographies in English of her in London, which, of course, this is the change that I talk about. So the how to put it, renovation on a larger scale. But I do not say that these women have not been around. I actually do believe that they have been around for a while. Even the mother of Lungpu Man himself is believed to have achieved a level of Arya Bhukkhana. And so many mothers of the forest tradition are believed to have achieved these extraordinary advanced states of mind. Another example would be the mother of Lungpu Duan, for example. Yeah, so thank you very much. I'm afraid I have to go now because the Tour de France will start in Leeds, and I was told that at 4 they will close down some of the major roads and streets here in Leeds, and I have to pick up my daughter. But I really sincerely hope that this was interesting and beneficial. Thank you so much.